Three, two, one.
Welcome, everyone, to this week's episode of The No Normal Show, brought to you by Revive. This is where we leave all things status quo, traditional, old school, and boring in the dust and celebrate the new, the powerful, the innovative, the future, all related to how brands can lead the way in health. I'm your co-host, Stephanie Weirbill, EVP of Integrated Marketing, and I'm joined today by two extremely exciting guests. We've got two Revivers with us who are both freshly back from Health 2023, the health conference, HLTH Health in Las Vegas. Our guests are Brennan Mason, VP of Strategy at Revive. Hi again, Brennan.
Hello, Stephanie.
Good to have you back. Brennan is sort of a reoccurring guest on this show. And we're also joined by a new guest, Caroline Case, content creator at Revive. Hello, Caroline.
How's it going?
Hi, great to have you here. I'll give a little background on Brennan and Caroline. Brennan is a healthcare growth expert, tech enthusiast, and policy journeyman. At Revive, he builds scalable and measurable marketing programs for leading health systems and healthcare vendors and health tech organizations, B2B organizations, all of the above. Before his time at Revive, he served as a chief marketing officer for healthcare interoperability company Bridge Connector. And my favorite fun fact, he is also a 12-year veteran of the U.S. Army and Army Reserve.
And so excited I've hit recurring character status. That feels very important. I will make sure I update that bio.
Yeah, absolutely. You really are recurring character. So Caroline, joining us for the first time, is a writer and content creator extraordinaire. She spends her days sifting through all kinds of wonky healthcare things like industry shift, policy changes, healthcare service offerings, and then takes all of that and really creates extremely digestible, easy to understand health educational pieces for consumers, service line marketing programs for health systems, and thought pieces for healthcare executives. So we are so happy you're here, Caroline, and joining us to bring all of your smarts to the table.
So happy to be here. Thank you.
Awesome. So let's get right into it. As we mentioned, all three of us went to Health 2023 a couple weeks ago now. We're recovering from that Vegas life. For those who haven't been to Health before, we'll give a little recap of what is it, why should you be there, who else is there, and then we'll get into a few themes that we uncovered. So I'm just going to ask first, Brennan, you've been to Health like every year since it started. So tell us a little bit from your perspective, what is Health and what's it like to attend?
Health calls itself, that health technology innovation-ish conference. It's very investor-driven. It's been investor-driven at its core, and it does have a really, really good job of that. But they've really expanded the scope of the content to be just about general healthcare transformation, innovation, all with the lens and focus on technology, though.
Yeah, I saw it was, a LinkedIn post, maybe sponsored by Health, but it was a headline that was like, Health eats all other healthcare conferences. And I'm like, yeah, I think that's accurate. Like every year I've gone, it's just gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's become, every company under the sun that touches healthcare in any way. So providers, health tech, it's consumer brands that are moving into healthcare. It's everyone from diagnostics to, primary care to even just investors and VC, as Brennan mentioned. Super fun.
Speaking of eats, great food. Fantastic right. Food. If you want a poke bowl at 2:30 in the afternoon, Health has got you covered.
Yeah. You know what they didn't do this year, though, that they did last year was serving mimosas and Bloody Marys and like Four Horsemen at 9 a.m.
Good Lord. I can't.
No, not there for that. So Caroline, it was your first time. So tell us, what was it like from your vantage point?
Oh, wow. I would call it a health marketer's playground. You are surrounded by some of the most intelligent people in healthcare. There's so much to do, so much to learn. It was overwhelming at first, just it's the scale of Health and it's so massive. But it was so educational. I got to go to around 17 sessions. And it's still streaming afterwards. So still learning, but it was definitely an experience for the books.
Awesome. I'm going to ask Brennan, since you've been a few years, what was different this year? Was there anything that felt different, any energy that had changed?
It was huge. I mean, it's been growing every year, but this year it truly felt really, really big. I also like the idea of bringing the sessions in where the exhibits are and basically just making it kind of like one big room of energy. So it doesn't feel like you're trying to bop around to this and that. Everything feels like a very important conversation. You know, there's no session that is tucked away in a hotel ballroom with 10 people. Everything feels big. It feels important. It was really, really interesting to see just how big it's gotten.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. I think it also seems to be shifting more towards networking and conversations. This year it had the vibe of like deals being made in real time. It was not just the convention center, but it was all the hotels around the convention center where people were sitting down having coffee, talking about business, you know, venture capitalists and PE firms and investors all over the place, kind of seeing what's new and interesting. It felt much more conversational to me this year. I think that just the vibe of having the sessions in the exhibition floor kind of did that. But next year it's back to the Venetian. So we'll see, you know, how that continues to change as we go forward. And I guess we should disclose we are a sponsor of Health. So if it sounds like we're getting really advertising-y, we do love Health. We love it, I think, at our true core. And also Revive is a sponsor. So, you know, we put our money where our hearts is and have a booth and love to have our own conversations as well. So with that, let's dig into what we saw and heard. So all of us have, you know, taken copious notes and kind of gotten together and boiled down a few key themes. So we're going to hit three or four, depending on what we have time for. So I'll just give a setup for each and then want to hear from Brennan and Caroline on thoughts. The first is what we're calling the funnel war. Rage is on. So for our longtime listeners, you all know that in Joe Public 2030, which is Revive's most recent book, which predicts the future of healthcare, we predicted that there will be a race to the top of the acuity funnel. So what that means is new entrants have come on the scenes and they're focused on everything at the top of the acuity funnel, being wellness and primary care and telehealth and mental health and home health. And that's folks like Amazon, Walgreens, Apple, CVS Health, Walgreens. And nowhere is that more true than at the health conference, where you see, you know, a little walk down the exhibit floor takes you through Best Buy and Google and Verizon and Philips and all those kinds of folks. And you see all of these new offerings. You hear conversations about the future of primary care and new offerings in telehealth. So it really feels like a funnel war central zone, if you will. So Caroline, I'll turn it to you first. As you kind of wandered through and had a lot of interesting conversations and listened to folks and listened to the talks and keynotes and people speak from the main stage, what were some of the trends that you heard about the top of the funnel?
Definitely. So from a session, retail and healthcare sitting in a tree, the brand Hims & Hers shared that one reason they're entering the primary care space is because the current primary care model is unsustainable, meaning it's ripe for disruption. So for example, 100 million Americans don't have a primary care provider. There's a shortage of over 30,000 psychiatrists that we'll see over the next year. So that traditional brick and mortar model, which is see your family physician each year, it's just no longer working, frankly. So they saw a business opportunity. So Hims & Hers originally started as a prescription service, but moved into primary care because it's broken. And they saw that huge business opportunity. Best Buy was another brand that was there. And as another example, they see caregivers dwindling in their ability to support patients. The workforce is dwindling as well, as we know. 100,000 nurses left over the last 2 years. So Best Buy sees that gap and is working on connecting patients, consumers, and care teams. Think Geek Squad, but make it healthcare.
So let me ask you, so you're throwing out some really interesting stats around staffing shortages and a lot of what, you know, legacy players are really struggling with, right? Which is like no access to primary care, can't find enough PCPs. We see a shortage of nurses coming, all of these things. So it's interesting because what I hear you saying is folks like Hims & Hers and even Best Buy are going, ooh, opportunity, right? So something is broken. We can fix it. And so they're kind of stepping in and saying, hey, maybe there's something for us to fix here. Let me ask you, Brennan, what are your thoughts on that? Do you think that these folks can really do that? That's a pretty big problem to solve.
Yeah, I agree with the idea that, you know, the way we've envisioned primary care for a long time is unsustainable. But I would raise the question, does that mean it's the wrong model? Because there's something about the idea of the family doctor that has persisted, and I think persisted for a good reason. Having a relationship with someone who knows you and knows your care and can help you plan your care and get access where you need and have nuanced conversations about you, the person, the patient, is very, very valuable. You know, I think, you know, there's some great, like, I think about Walmart. That one thing that's fantastic is, in theory, you could go to, you know, to a Walmart here in Nashville, then I could go to a Walmart in Modesto. And because, you know, they have, you know, a singular EHR instance, they have all my history, and that's great. But I am more than just my fields on my medical record. There's nuance to me, the individual. So as long as we're trying to still advocate for a good, like, provider-patient relationship, I'm all for it, because it's not working and not enough people have that right now. But I don't want to lose that, you know, just for the sake of progress. And, you know, from hearing them talk, a lot of them are talking about how important it is to have a relationship with the provider. So it feels like that's where their minds are as well.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned Walmart. Walmart had a session, Walmart Health, and they mentioned that their kind of North Star, I probably won't get the exact words right, but it was something around their vision is to make healthcare as convenient and easy as shopping. And I thought, oh, that actually does sound different to me. I mean, everyone's talked about convenience and the patient experience for decades and decades. But for Walmart to say, you know, we've made shopping easy and convenient and low prices, and we're going to do the same to healthcare, that felt like a really strong vision to me. And Caroline, you mentioned Best Buy is like geek squad for healthcare. Like, I want to live in that world, but also living in the healthcare industry world, I think we all realize and recognize that that is a lot harder than it sounds, but maybe not if you're focused on, you know, out of pocket X number, you know, of dollars for eye care, which is what Walmart's thinking. They're not talking about surgery. They're not here saying we're going to make hip surgery as easy as shopping. They're saying we're going to make preventive medicine as easy as shopping. So it's not new. We've been talking about it for 3 years. It's all over Joe Public, right? But it just feels like every year we get a little closer. So I'll just pause. Any other things that you all would add, or maybe be skeptical about?
Yeah, I would say that they're not here to upend the system. I think they're trying to integrate more fully into the system. So for example, Amazon Pharmacy. So Vin Gupta said that the current pharmacy experience in America is unacceptable. And specifically, medication non-adherence is one of the biggest healthcare problems that they don't talk enough about. So in an age where we underutilize pharmacists, in this moment of not having enough providers, Amazon is really leaning into their strengths of these specific pharmacists who are trying to provide that clinical expertise that patients demand and help them with medication non-adherence.
Yeah, I think they, the retailers, have such a huge piece to play when it comes to helping with access. When you just think about just the literal footprint that these retailers have that can be used to help access, especially if we're talking about routine care. I mean, they could be a huge remedy to that if they can do the right thing. I think part of that is making sure you have the right association so that you can actually help your complex patients and you're not just focusing on the people who, you know, can get their vaccines and blood work when they get their groceries. That's kind of the easy stuff. The hard stuff is managing complex patients who have a lot of care visits, comorbidities, things like that. And that's where this type of thing gets really difficult. But, you know, these companies have done lots of difficult things before. This is a little bit different, but I think they are structured to help that.
Yeah, great. Well, I think we could probably talk about this all day. I know it's one of my favorite topics. But I am curious, you know, for anyone who is in the disruptor space, who is continuing to move in this direction, you know, there's a long kind of journey here, right? There's the startups that have recognized a key problem in healthcare that they want to fix. Then there's the, on the other side of the spectrum, the large scale, very huge global consumer brands, the Amazons, the Apples, et cetera, that are moving into this space. And maybe then there's a million folks in between, right? So there's a pretty far spectrum here. So there's you know, a lot of different things that disruptors need to be thinking about as they shift into healthcare. Caroline, you attended a session called Healthcare Everywhere All at Once, and it was I kind of listened to the on-demand version, Amazon Clinic and Uber Health and DocGo and even a vending machine company called SOS, which I was like, that is brilliant. Can you share with us a little bit more? It seems like there was some learnings around what's working for disruptors as they move into healthcare and what can others learn from?
Certainly, yeah. So they recommended that non-traditional players like themselves with brand name recognition outside of healthcare can do two things. So the first is to lean into their existing strengths. So what does your brand do well for consumers? For Amazon, for example, that's convenience. For Walmart, it's price. For CVS and Walgreens, it's real estate footprint. For Uber Health, it's the size of the network of independent drivers and couriers and their consumer engagement platform. The second thing is to make sure that you explain what you do that enables you to not just be the same as consumer brands, but really play into the ecosystem as it exists, which is critical in healthcare. So Uber Health believes that it shouldn't follow the mistakes of big tech. So they're debunking the disruptor expectation that just like in the consumer space, everyone will bend to your will because there might be a better, easier, more convenient product. Caitlin Donovan from Uber Health shared, healthcare is an ecosystem and will always be an ecosystem. To not understand that and embed yourself within it, in the way that it works, in an omni-channel approach, in the way that the ecosystem pays, you're not going to effectuate the change you can hope for. So it's much easier to play by the rules and then inch folks forward, taking the appropriate role, given your strengths, than trying to change from the outside in. So I found that very interesting.
Yeah, and I think one of the first questions, you look at all these, you know, startup tech companies. I think Uber, you know, has a great point there. A lot of them are better options than the standard. But then you get into some of the actual hard questions. One, does it integrate with everything else? Because we got 50 different things that has to integrate. Is it secure? Is it compliant? You have to go that next step other than it does the task better. There's so much more to it.
Yeah, I think that quote, healthcare is an ecosystem and will always be an ecosystem, is frameable to me. It's tattooable. And it's been a theme of health for several years. Like, this idea of collaboration and partnerships has been a theme. And health is a space, to the point earlier about networking and conversations, it's a space where people are finding partners, finding interesting partners. Every healthcare organization has their own ecosystem of partners. And I think it was maybe a few years ago when Walgreens rolled out their vision for owning the continuum of healthcare. The way they rolled that out was by saying, we're making acquisitions, we're finding partnerships, and we're going after that. And so that is certainly a key opportunity for every organization, but especially some of the health system players, which is, okay, you're probably not going to stand up your own Uber Health. Like, you're just not, and that's fine. But what is your Uber Health partner, and where is your Walmart Health partner, and how much are you willing to give up in terms of your own options? So maybe we'll just close this out. Brennan, any final notes on how organizations can think about partnerships?
Yeah, I think, you know, if you're a health system looking at this, this might seem scary, and it could be, but I don't think it has to be. You know, but you have to figure out what you want to be as an organization. You have to decide, is this where we want to compete? Are we structured to compete here? And the answer very well could be, yes, absolutely. But then you actually have to commit to doing that. I think it's fine if a health system says, we don't want to compete here. They can do this better. We want to partner with them. Like, this is going to be our primary care footprint, is all of these retail players that are doing this and have all these locations, things that it would take us millions or literally billions of dollars to build up ourselves. I think that is just a conversation that you need to have and not necessarily be afraid of it.
Yeah, wonderful. Okay, great. So that's theme one, the funnel wars continues to rage on. Theme two, we'll get a little more nerdy here. So our next theme is around value-based care, VBC, our old friend. And, you know, there's kind of a push and a pull here. There's some interesting tension that we found. So there's a lot of conversation at health. I mean, any healthcare conference you're going to hear about BBC. But the kind of back channel convo was like, oof, we've been having the same conversation for a decade. Bayou has been right around the corner. So Caroline, do you want to share with us a little bit of the conversation around why it's been so hard? And you know, just sort of the reason for the latency.
Yeah. So value-based care, it's a term used everywhere, and they acknowledge that at the conference. So 15 years ago, it started as outcome-based, and then it was payment reform. Then it became about access. Then it became about health equity. Now the loose definition panelists claim is bad for society, they said, because it has lost its meaning. Everyone has their own definition. So in one session in value-based care in a multi-payer world, Alicia Limo from Biogen brought up the importance of the letter C, so the care part. What do you care about? What is your mission and what is your purpose? If it's about the patient or the patient outcome, it's important. But ideologies aside, something's awry. According to another health session, is the VBC experiment working? A 2022 survey showed that less than half of primary care physicians had received any value-based payments.
Yeah, so it seems like kind of a theme here is those who have been fee-for-service forever and ever, especially, you know, physicians and the original kind of healthcare model, are struggling to change, struggling to shift. And so to your point, Caroline, are not even, you know, receiving value-based payments, which is not surprising. Like, I want to be super clear. That's not surprising. That's not new news. Like, we all know how hard it is. We all recognize how hard it is to change the ship. And even I think it was discussed that, like, this is not taught in medical schools like it could be, and we still have a lot of work to do. But on the other hand, Brennan, I thought you had some really interesting points as you've spent your career on the other side of things. You've spent your career in the health tech side of things. So what are you seeing that may be very different in this space?
So value-based care is so interesting. It's so hard to do. The idea, I think, is a very good idea. I'd probably fight that a little bit. I don't think it's bad for society. I think it's good. I think it's very good for society, especially if we want this model of U.S. healthcare to succeed. I think it is necessary. In technology, like going back to health, most of these companies, when they are trying to sell to employers or health plans, they're talking about value and they're talking about risk. And they're not PMPM is kind of the old way of doing business, even though some of them might charge that way. It's all about value and risk, with many of them going all the way into actual, you know, value-based pricing or risk-based pricing into their solutions. And so that's kind of the default. It's just the default, you know, whereas the analogy, the PMPM model, which is more analogous to a fee-for-service model, is kind of the exception or a little bit more surprising. That's how they can talk about their software, is about how it can lead to higher value care or lower risk for your patient population. It's a little bit easier for them because we're talking about, you know, an individual solution, reducing risk. That is far less complex than trying to reduce risk for a Medicare ACO population. That is extremely difficult, and it takes a long time to do that right. I think there's some impatience there. We're trying to basically change the engines on a plane while keeping the plane in flight. I think the transition to value-based reimbursement is one of the most difficult things that this industry will have accomplished since the inception of Medicare. Like, it is that big of a deal. And I think it's really easy to get frustrated with it, but that's still where you need to guide yourself. Like, guide yourself towards value-based reimbursement. And for the individual physician, it can be very frustrating because, you know, individual physician would say, I've always done value-based care for my patients. I always want to deliver the value-based care. But it goes past just the individual physician, especially if we're looking at complex patients. It's about how we navigate the patient through care, how we increase compliance, et cetera, et cetera. But for the individual physician, just with the way, you know, the regulatory and policy world is going, it will become extremely difficult to be financially successful without doing some value-based reimbursement. And that's just how it's going to be, unfortunately, unless there's some type of major change. So I think there's some lessons to take from at least how we start the conversation. You know, if can we shift the idea of our default being fee for service to our default being about value? Whenever we're talking about reimbursement or care, we're leading with the conversation about value.
Yeah, I love that because that feels like a practical entry point. It's not make the shift. It's not, you know, completely reorient everything. It's just start the conversation in this way, which I think is useful. A lot of the folks that show up at Health, sort of the newer entrants, are talking about things in the outcome-based way. So for example, if, you know, Parsley Health maybe is an example. So they are a primary care company, and they're trying to kind of break the model of primary care, and they speak every year at Health. And what they've moved into in the last year is targeting health plans and making sure they're getting coverage through health plans. So how do they do that? They talk about how their model is ultimately better for patients and has better outcomes and leads to, you know, faster, you know, kind of catching of issues, which then of course is less cost for health plans in the long term. So maybe that's just one simple example for how these folks are leading with an outcome-based solution. So why don't we move on to our final theme here? And, you know, there's no surprises on what this theme is. It's everywhere, all the time. If you turn on any news, you know, or open your news feed, it's all about AI, right? And certainly Health was no different. It's all about AI. Pretty much every conversation, every booth, every session mentioned AI in some ways. So why don't I turn it to you, Brennan, to first give us a little overview of a few initial, you know, kind of things that you heard at a high level, and then the rest of us will jump in.
Yeah, I don't think it was surprising that became the hot word this year. Every year there's some type of hot word. It was AI this year for sure. Not surprising. What I saw was I think a lot of companies who were already doing stuff like this now just talking more outwardly about, oh yeah, it's AI. Because if you want to get super picky about it, you know, there's a lot of different ways to do AI, and machine learning is probably the biggest one. And almost every solution now has some type of machine learning and probably deep learning. If you don't, then you're pretty far behind. And so now we can just, you know, call that AI because it is a type of AI and say, look at this great AI we have. So almost every solution has some type of machine learning incorporated into it, which is why it's so easy for everyone to start talking about AI because everyone's kind of doing it in some way. Like I said, although if you want to get really picky about AI versus machine learning, which I don't think you do, maybe you do, I don't know. then
I always do.
So machine learning and deep learning is about programmatically making your software get smarter on its own. AI traditionally is about emulating human intelligence. And there's a lot of different ways. Machine learning and deep learning are just two ways of doing AI. There are other ways of doing AI that are not machine learning and deep learning. I didn't see that at Health, which is not surprising because we're talking about software. Like, it makes sense that it's mostly the other stuff.
Yeah, and a lot of the conversation at Health was about generative AI just because it's what's hot right now and everyone's excited about it. But my favorite meme that I've seen, I look at AI memes because I'm a weirdo, but Brennan, we'll see if this resonates with you. It says something like, if it's written in code, it's probably machine learning. If it's written in PowerPoint, it's probably AI. And I'm like, I love that. I love that.
That's fantastic. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. Yeah, because AI, when people talk about it, it's the concept, right? It's the concept, yeah. Hopefully the use case, because AI is not a use case. It's not a strategy. It's we need to get to what's the use case of it. But machine learning is like the actual, like, what are you doing with it, if you will. That's my layman's term overview. Anyway, we're going down a nerdy rabbit hole here. Caroline, why don't you share with us a little bit? You attended a really interesting session with Google and Axios. Tell us a little bit about what happened there.
I did, yes. So it was called Bringing AI to Healthcare Responsibly. And it was a discussion between James Manica from Google and Aaron Broadwin from Axios, and it did get a little spicy. So according to Google, the work that they're doing with large language models, that the work they're doing with genetics, mammography screening, iCAD, DermAssist, these don't require you to capture patient data. And the moderator from Axios really just honed in on that. She was she kept asking about data. And but this presumption that all of it requires personal data in AI is mistaken, because what they're looking for is patterns in data, patterns in images, patterns in these radiology scans. That's what they're working with. So in cancer treatment and radiotherapy, for example, there's something that happens where patients are getting scanned. It's called contouring, and they're separating the cancerous cells from the healthy cells. You don't need a patient's data to do that. And so they're using AI techniques to enable care providers to do that work of contouring all within a few minutes, before it would take three people with PhDs. And Google has learned their lessons from the past. So today they have some of the strongest privacy principles for how they deal with patient and consumer data. Google Cloud, they said, doesn't keep any customer data, for example. So they're trying to stay focused on preserving privacy and learn from their lessons from the past.
Yeah, and there's a real like societal question we have to ask ourselves about what we're willing to give up to get. Because if you want fantastic AI solutions that help advise care or catch things, it has to ingest historical like clinical data. There's probably someone smarter than me that's screaming right now that's saying like, no, it can work without it. I don't understand how you can get that without using actual data. And that raises a whole thing about consent and how you actually get consent for the use of data. But it's not, it's just more of a larger question about what are we willing to do? Because we, the way it sounded like at Health is we all want the lemonade without the lemons. And it does, I just don't think it works like that. And I don't have an answer to that question. It's just something that I think is just a more broad question that we have to figure out.
Yeah. And it is the multi-billion dollar question right now, which is we know that every new technology comes with consequences down the road that we're not aware of today. And so, I mean, I personally am really excited about the work that folks like Google are doing, which is to try to identify what are the most responsible ways to do it based on what we know now and based on where we are right now. So it was a really interesting session because it was about ethical, you know, responsibility and how we get there in healthcare. The other interesting conversation that there was a session about the AI hype cycle, and there was a lot of back and forth around, you know, how do you pressure test if you are purchasing or partnering with AI vendors and looking for solutions? How do you pressure test whether they really work and whether they're a long-term, you know, viable option? And so the CEO and co-founder of CureAI Health was talking about, you know, there's so many shiny demos out there. Like, that just really hit home with me because I think we all see them, maybe even in our news feeds and in our LinkedIns, right? There's so many folks that are taking a ChatGPT or another large language model or a Midjourney or Stable Diffusion or whatever it is, a Google Bard, and they're feeding that as an API into some kind of shiny demo and selling it. Well, okay, cool. But how do we really, if, you know, as we're pressure testing, you know, various solutions, make sure that we get deeply down into how it works? And so I thought that was interesting because for all the vendors out there, I know when we attended Vive earlier this year, there was what felt like thousands of point solutions, AI-based point solutions. And so for all the vendors out there, your number one job is to make sure that you can easily and kind of in an approachable way show and tell how does your solution work at its core. And then what are all of the, you know, kind of things that you're thinking through from a responsibility standpoint? Brennan, it seems like you have a take.
Yeah, because, I mean, you see this on every trend. I call them hype hustlers, where they see the hype and they say, how can I cash in on this as low effort as possible and pretend like I'm delivering value using this new thing? And I think you see this not just in healthcare, putting a new UI on a GPT-4 integration and presenting it as some novel new thing. And, you know, that's just the reality. And it can be hard to parse who's the hype hustler and who's actually legit.
Yeah. Well, let's end there, right? So the takeaway is don't be a hype hustler.
Don't be a hype hustler. If you do, I guess, like, do it good, I guess. I don't know.
Do it shinier than the other one. No. So I'm just going to sum up a few things I've heard from you all, and you can add any other kind of actionable next steps or takeaways for folks. So number one, Brennan, you talked earlier about figure out what you really want to do and where you want to compete and play and where you need to partner. Don't be a hype hustler. Be skeptical about AI and really pressure test what's out there. I will add in, we think everyone should be at health. It's just a fun time. It's just a great time to talk to folks who are weird like
us. So much
us.
Food. Yeah. So much food, y'all. So much good food.
What else would you add? Anything you build on that, Caroline and Brennan, before we take our outro?
Retail health is here to stay, and it might take over primary care. Just might.
Ooh, dropping that controversial mic.
Just you need to be talking about how you're going to work in a retail health world. You need to figure it out or start to figure it out. It's not going to happen overnight, but you should be thinking about it now.
Yeah, and it should go farther than putting your logo on your local urgent care or retail health outlet.
Yeah, rebranding your local urgent care is not going to do it.
Yeah. Okay. So with that, we'll wrap up a great show. Thank you. This was really fun, you all. It was fun to be with you all in Vegas, and it was fun to talk about it, you know, after the fact. Caroline and Brennan, thank you all so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Stephanie. Such a joy. Mm-hmm. Don't fall for the hype, hustlers.
That's right. Don't do it. So for all you listening, thank you so much for joining in. As always, if you want us to cover something, shoot us an email. We are here at nonormal@reviveagency.com. Share the show. Give us a review and ratings. We love that. And don't be satisfied with the normal. Push that no normal. Don't be a hype hustler. And we'll see you next time.
3, 2, 1.
Here we go.